From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a look at hospital wards before the days of anesthesia, sterilization, and professional nurses. I speak with Charles Rosenberg, author of The Care of Strangers, A History of America's Hospital System. Also today, I speak with Japanese poet Nanao Sakaki. American poets Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg first met him when they traveled through Japan in the 60s. At the urging of Snyder, a volume of Sakaki's poems has been published in America. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the career of the late Bobby Fuller, who had a top 10 hit with I Fought the Law. And book critic John Leonard reviews Noel Virtue's first novel, The Redemption of Elsdon Bird. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The hospital is in some ways peculiarly characteristic of our society. Within the walls of a single building, high technology, bureaucracy, and professionalism are juxtaposed with the most fundamental and unchanging of human experiences, birth, death, pain. So begins Charles Rosenberg's new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. Rosenberg is a professor of the history and sociology of science at the University of Pennsylvania and has spent the last 20 years studying the history of medicine. Sooner or later, just about all of us rely on a hospital for our own health care or for that of a loved one. Rosenberg's book traces the circumstances of the past that led to the medical triumphs as well as to the social and economic controversies of our hospitals today. Rosenberg visited our studios earlier today. I asked him to elaborate on something that he says in the beginning of his book. He writes, "It is no accident that both black comedy and soap opera should have found the hospital a natural setting."
I wanted to emphasize in the beginning of the book how, unlike many other modern bureaucratic institutions, school board, headquarters, the Pentagon, that somehow hospitals are very close to the most elemental human needs and desires, that no matter how high-tech the techniques are that you're being subjected to, somehow you're still a person with very basic human needs. And somehow the juxtaposition of the bureaucratic, technological, with these needs creates this ironic situation. And I just thought that metaphor was a good way of expressing it.
Yeah, you described the bureaucratic and the mystical being side by side in the hospital. I thought that was nice. Reading your book, I understood something that I thought I never really understood before. And that is, when I was growing up, a lot of the grandparents were really afraid of hospitals in a way that I thought was almost irrational. And they didn't want to go no matter how sick they were. And I always thought that they were adult enough that they weren't afraid of the pain. Do you know what I mean? They weren't afraid of medicine so much, but they had this terror about hospitals. Reading your book, I understand it, because hospitals used to be poorhouses, places that people who could afford to stay away from did.
Yeah, well, that's half of it. I think that the stigmatization of being identified as a recipient of charity for people up until the very recent past, and maybe up until the present, depending on who you are, has always been very frightening. It takes your dignity away. And was meant to take your dignity away. There's another part of it, too, and that is what you might call the more personal, individual sense that you want to be in your family when you're sick, when you're near death, when you're in discomfort. And traditionally, people who could afford it were always treated at home. And that medical care was always seen in a family context. And doctors wrote about, you know, how you'd handle the wife or the servants or the sick room. And it was only in the very historically sense, relatively recent past, that people went to hospitals at all. So I think that if your grandparents felt that way, it was a combination of those two elements, the strangeness and alienness of it on the one hand, and then this charity stigma on the other.
And there's also the terrible conditions that used to exist at some of the hospitals. You describe, well, I think you describe in 1810, for instance, walking, what it would be like walking down the street, passing a hospital, and the kind of stench that would be coming out of the hospital. Would you explain it?
Well, I think we have enough impressionistic accounts of that kind so that what you say is pretty accurate. Everyone did agree that there was this hospital smell, it was called. And a certain amount of it, of course, was just bringing a lot of people together in one place. Remember, they didn't have modern sanitation. But also infections. People with any kind of lesion, would start smelling. I mean, it's very hard to understand today. But if you put a lot of them together, and in fact, it was natural for medical men and most laymen to believe as well that that smell was somehow a part of the process of contagion. And one of the things they were afraid of in the period before the 1880s or so is infection in the hospital, because it was believed, and with good reason, that you had a greater chance of getting reinfected or infected with something different inside the crowded confines of a hospital than you would at random or in your own home. And that smell somehow seemed to embody that.
You also describe how there would be dirty, filthy sheets hanging from outside the hospital windows.
Well, not every hospital, but I have found accounts of individual hospitals, and some of them not just the almshouse, city hospitals that were clearly less well-maintained than the more prestigious voluntary hospitals, so that the people who had ran those hospitals had an uphill battle in fighting dirt and contagion. And also, remember, they didn't have professional nurses. They didn't have a work staff that was trained in any formal way.
There is an illustration in your book of three patients in Bellevue in a ward, and there's rats. This is Bellevue Hospital, and there's rats crawling over the bed sheets that the patients are lying in. Was there a really serious rat infestation problem in hospitals, or is this just somebody's horror story?
I think that it was media.
This is also from the 1800s. Let me get that clear.
This was from the 1850s. This particular picture was from the 1850s, and I think it was meant to horrify. I mean, it was meant to cater to all those fears in the layman's mind, laywoman's mind, about what a hospital would be like. I think it was clearly hype, I mean, in the sense of exaggerated. On the other hand, there are many accounts of rat and more likely cockroaches, bedbugs, lice as endemic and, ever-present in these hospitals of this period. I mean, the rats are probably a little melodramatic.
So part of the problem if you were hospitalized back in the 1800s was that you were being put in an atmosphere where you were as likely to pick up somebody else's disease as you were to get rid of your own. You were exposed to bedbugs and lice, sometimes bad sanitation because of overcrowding.
Yeah. But still remember that I think it's easy to look back and say that this was a terrible situation. But it's also easy to forget how miserable the conditions were of the working class poor in 19th century cities. I know we have terrible conditions today in North Philadelphia, in the city where I live, or in South Bronx, and there are equivalent sections in most big cities. But the kinds of deprivation are very hard to even understand. People had chronic malnutrition. If you look at patient records, women often had not menstruated for 6 months when they were admitted. That was standard because of malnutrition. One of the most common admissions diagnoses was something called ulcers, which were just infections that didn't heal on your feet, and which we don't have the equivalent today. And almost everyone who thinks about it or has written about it assumes that it was due to malnutrition. People lived crowded in one room and had no decent sanitary conditions. Most of the patients were drawn from the working class, many of them immigrants, or immigrants from the countryside or from a foreign country, who didn't have a family to take care of them. So often, even if they had a decent job, they were skilled craftsmen when they were working. When they stopped working and got sick, they just lay there because they lived in a boarding house, they lived in a furnished room, and so that no matter how bad the hospital conditions that we've been discussing were, it was still a lot better than lying untended with no food, perhaps not even adequate covering, in a bare room. So that I think we have to adjust our sense of what the aspirations of the working class were.
My guest is Charles Rosenberg, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. Let's talk about some of the medical and social factors that started to change what hospitals were like. Why don't we begin with the greater understanding of sterilization and disinfectants that came about in the mid-1800s through the work of Dr. Joseph Lister. Now, just to put this into context, before there was an understanding of disinfecting in hospitals, what was surgery like?
Well, the revolution, I think probably the most important technical change, single technical change, in making the modern hospital a place where middle-class people would go and which became sort of central to medical care was surgery. And there were lots of changes. I mean, antisepsis was one of them. But, of course, the first major change was anesthesia, which was introduced in the late 1840s. Before that, not only was there tremendous danger of infection from any kind of surgical procedure or the treatment of trauma, you know, street accidents or workplace accidents, but, of course, the patient was in pain while you were operating on them. And you... They did give them alcohol and opium, which worked pretty well, as a matter of fact, but of course not like general anesthesia. So that surgeons had a very limited range of things they could do, given their given those options. And they had to do them very fast, because the patient might die from shock, might try to jump off the table. They didn't handle the loss of blood very well. So the surgery played a relatively minor part in the hospital. It was interesting to the medical students, of course. And the surgeons had to have a will of iron and a temperament of iron in order to be a good surgeon. But the first major change did come with anesthesia. But, of course, just keeping a person from jumping off the table when you were operating on them didn't mean you were going to have a better outcome. And, in fact, there's some statistics that seem to indicate that outcomes got worse because they could operate more slowly, which allowed greater opportunity for infection. It wasn't until the 1860s and 70s, with Pasteur and Joseph Lister's work, that they began to think about the possibility of infection by microorganisms and to try to work out techniques to keep those microorganisms out of open wounds. But it was a long, slow process to get surgeons to accept and understand what this might mean. It was not something like anesthesia that was simple and easy to understand. And it took really about 25 years in this country for a new generation of surgeons to come in and more or less consistently accept what infection meant, the idea that one little tiny organism could have all these enormous effects on the whole body. So that was a very gradual period of change.
You describe how before that understanding, a surgeon might drop one of their instruments on the floor, pick it up, wipe it on his sleeve and proceed with the operation.
And still think they would follow antiseptic procedures. You see, because they had covered the instrument with carbolic acid before they started the operation. But it took a long time for the mechanism of how infection might take place to really sink into the surgeon's minds.
Once the medical profession understood more about antisepsis, how did that change the structure of the hospital and the kind of care patients got?
Well, I think again, these changes are gradual. It made surgery more important in terms of the organization within the hospital, of staffing organization. Surgery began to move from homes into the hospital because once you accepted the idea that antisepsis was necessary and then asepsis, of course, a rich person could try to turn their living room or bedroom into a surgical amphitheater, take the drapes down, clean it, boil water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it very soon became clear that it was much better to do it in a specially built room in which you could have an autoclave, you could have trained nurses that were experienced with operative techniques available to work on it. And gradually, surgery moved out of the home and into the hospital. And I think, and it's not only that these technical reasons existed, but that people began to accept them and understand them. People meaning laymen, of course.
I want to talk with you more about how the history of the hospital has led to the kind of hospital system that we're used to now. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Charles Rosenberg, author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Charles Rosenberg is my guest, the author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, which is a history of America's hospital system. Let's talk about nursing, and you think that Florence Nightingale is one of the people most responsible for changing the American hospital and for changing the medical profession as well. Before she came along, who were the nurses in hospitals, or who performed the tasks that we now associate with nurses?
Well, it's a simple question, but there's a complicated answer. First, the generation of Florence Nightingale and her supporters painted a very, very dark picture. In that picture or history, all the early nurses before Florence Nightingale were sort of retired prostitutes or feeble alcoholics. The fact is that most of the nurses didn't fall into either of those categories. Many of them were not trained in a formal sense. They didn't go to nursing school and have credentials. But many of them were recovered patients who'd worked their way up, starting out being what in the effect aides, to use a term that will be familiar today, and becoming a very responsible ward nurses, they were called. So they had a kind of on-the-job competence. The other aspect of nursing that is unfamiliar is that it was 50% male. It was assumed you'd have male nurses in male wards, female nurses in female wards. And they were assisted, on the whole, by recovering patients.
Well, you credit Florence Nightingale with thinking that the hospitals needed female morality and a middle-class female morality brought to it to promote the healing process. What do you think is the legacy in modern healthcare of Florence Nightingale's approach to nursing?
Well, one of her arguments was this kind of feminist argument that women in their nature had an understanding of the spiritual qualities that were necessary for healing. Another was that by being middle class, they could bring order and cleanliness into the hospital so that there would be, at different levels, this enormous impact on the wards. But as is often the case in many other areas of women trying to create a special role for themselves, insofar as they've based that role on some mystical, spiritual quality of women, they've painted themselves into a corner. Because if they're spiritual, well, then the intellectual qualities are somebody else's, namely the doctor's. And so that there's always been this kind of symbiosis between nurses and doctors in which the nurses have been subordinate. This will be unpopular with many nurses listening to this, but I think that there's been a de facto reform in which the nurses have moved ahead and gotten more and more status and more security, but it's always been as the doctor's lieutenant in the ward situation. And so insofar as the medical profession status has improved, nursing has improved as well, but always under the arm or the cloak of the medical profession, which is seen as having a higher status because it's somehow in control of the decision-making and of the intellectual resources of medicine. One of the problems of medicine has been this consistent high status of the technical aspects and perhaps less consistent attention to the sociological, psychological, quote, moral factors Florence Nightingale would have called them moral. We wouldn't quite use the word the way she does. And I think in that sense, the nursing profession has carved a role out for itself, but that role has been necessarily subordinate historically.
I want to skip ahead to the present and look at some of the reasons for problems that we're having in medical care today. We've talked about how antisepsis changed hospital life and about how nursing changed. The hospital system in America used to be mostly for poor people, as you pointed out, people who could afford to stay home and were cared for at home. And eventually, you point out in your book that wealthy people were given private rooms in hospitals, but the big problem was the working class and the middle class, who were neither poor nor wealthy, neither poor enough to be served for free nor wealthy enough to afford hospital care. Do you think that medical insurance is one of the most important factors in shaping the modern hospital used to know?
There's no question about that. And in fact, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, even before the Depression was perceived as a major problem, this social problem was of great concern to all hospital experts. In other words, they knew that middle-class people, because of this heritage of not wanting to take charity, didn't want to be in a charity ward. And they knew that they couldn't afford private rooms and private doctors' fees in the hospital. And going back to the very turn of the century, there were some attempts to deal with it. For example, many hospitals started instituting what we would call semi-private rooms, where there'd be four people, let's say, instead of the normal 28 or 24 people. Another technique was to build special wings of hospitals that were all semi-private that would cater to the middle class, because it was felt that it wasn't right to take a middle-class person and subject them to a situation where they would not only have to take charity, but be mixed in a ward with people with different habits, different language, and in a sense polluted is a strong word, but be subject to unpleasant social associations.
Another change in the model in the modern hospital is the kind of technology that we have now, which is just extraordinary. You write in your book that you think that the hospital is really a microcosm of our values, is a microcosm of America's social values. How do you mean that?
I think that's probably no more than a cliche, but I think the hospital illustrates it very well, because it does concentrate in one institution the faith we have in technology, the desires for living longer, living healthier lives, a kind of what you might call a kind of secular salvation, a better life here on earth, and a willingness to pay as much as possible for it. There's a kind of what I call a technological gradient, that if something can be done, it should be done. That somehow, if in the worst case that might come into the hospital, machine X or machine Y might be necessary, well, then you need it, of course. And so we've become accustomed to not making cost-conscious decisions in the way England has had to make cost-conscious decisions. They just haven't been as rich as we have. And in the great period of hospital expansion, after World War II, with third-party payment in the Blue Cross, with Medicare, Medicaid in the mid-60s, was also a period of enormous technological change and development, CAT scans and NMR, and you could just list it, list all the changes and take 10 or 15 minutes just to name techniques. And this was all in a context of cost-plus reimbursement. So there was no reason not to invest in technology, because it was going to be reimbursed. And no one thought it was a bad thing because, well, who wanted to skimp on health? But what's happened is that we've, again, to use the same metaphor I did before, painted ourselves into a corner where costs have spiraled so much that even under a Republican administration that has said it's dedicated to getting government off everyone's backs, they've devoted an extraordinary amount of energy to cost-cutting on a centralized basis. And I think that would have happened under any administration.
We've talked a lot about the hospital of the past and the problems the hospital of the past had. How would you evaluate the hospital of the present in America? I mean, surely it's no longer a lice-infested poorhouse. What do you think are well, I think it's clear what the strengths of our modern hospital system is now. The strengths are now excellent health care, incredible technology. What do you think of the problems now?
Well, you know, some of the problems are ones that were perceived as early as 1910 and 1920. And I think that, I don't mean to be a pessimist, but it does indicate that they're very deep-seated and very built into the structure of the institution. One is this tremendous faith in technology, which manifests itself in the hospital in a disproportionate interest in acute care and not much interest in chronic or extended care of any sort. And this has been exacerbated by the demographic changes. In other words, we've gotten rid of most of the infectious diseases. The infant mortality pattern has changed. But we have a lot of old people. And we are not prepared to deal with either the human consequences, where are these people going to be taken care of, under what circumstances, or the economic consequences in terms of issues like Social Security, for example.
Have you ever been hospitalized?
Well, I haven't been. I was hospitalized when I was a child. I broke my arm, and I once had pneumonia. Actually, I must confess, everyone has a hospital experience. My mother died of cancer about 10 years ago after a very long and extremely unpleasant illness. And I was impressed at the time by the disproportion, put it that way, between the technical skills of the physicians involved and the lack of human skills that they had. I'm not going to mention the hospital or location,
of course.
And I had a parallel experience, very different experience, but one that illustrates another aspect of the hospital. And that is that I have two children, one 5 and one 23. And in the 18 years between those two events, those two births, the entire social context of childbirth changed in big city hospitals. When my first child was born, you know, husbands or others or affiliates were not allowed anywhere near the process. In fact, it was verboten to have any layman nearby. A lot of anesthesia was used, and by the early 80s, when my second child was born, it was much more nurse-centered, it was patient-oriented, anesthesia was not used, but discouraged, and certainly the kinds of anesthetics, this is a technical question, I don't want to get involved in it, had changed entirely, and of course husbands, associates were encouraged to be there during birth. Now, without placing a value on which is better or worse, I think what's striking there is how the hospital responded to changing values and attitudes, everything from the feminist movement to consumer changes. And in that sense, the hospital is responding. It is a social institution that's responding to perceived changes out in the real world, which then become become demand factors. If hospital A doesn't do it, well, they'd better because hospital B is doing it. So that I've seen these changes, you know, personally, and have impressed me with the fact that even if the hospital does have certain rigidities built into the technology, it also has a capacity for change, even if sometimes you wonder about how slowly that change is taking place.
So we end on an optimistic note.
Well, I tried.
Charles Rosenberg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Charles Rosenberg, and he's the author of the new book, The Care of Strangers, The Rise of America's Hospital System. The book is published by Basic Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with playwright Arthur Miller, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his play Death of a Salesman. He's just written his autobiography. It's titled Time Bends. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with Japanese writer Nanao Sakaki. He's a wandering poet and storyteller whose work has been championed in America by poet Gary Snyder. A collection of poems has just been published in America. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells whatever happened to Bobby Fuller, the man who sang I Fought the Law. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Redemption of Elsden Bird, the first novel by New Zealand writer Noel Virtue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Mark Boardman in Washington. Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze said today they've removed the last obstacles in the way of a medium-range missile treaty. Both men emerged from 2 days of talks in Geneva to announce that the treaty, eliminating medium-range missiles from Europe, would be ready for signing in Washington on December 9th. Shultz said the U.S. is satisfied that the proposed treaty is verifiable.
We will follow these declared missiles during the course of the 3-year period during which they will be destroyed. And we will inspect the destruction of the missiles, the launchers, and certain support facilities during the 3-year period of their destruction.
In Denver today, President Reagan said he's pleased with the news from Geneva. He was speaking to employees of the Martin Marietta Company who are working on the Star Wars Strategic Defensive Initiative. Mr. Reagan said he would not give up the Star Wars program to get a strategic missile treaty with the Soviets, and he praised the workers for their efforts in developing the space-based military system.
You are laboring to develop a defensive system that will change history. Once you've completed your work, the world will never be the same.
The president claims the Soviets have spent about $200 billion over the past 10 years developing their own Star Wars system. In Atlanta and Oakdale, Louisiana, Cuban detainees who don't want to be deported to Cuba continue to control two federal prisons. Over the past few days, inmates at those facilities rioted. At least one person was killed, dozens hurt, several buildings were destroyed, and more than 100 hostages are still being held. In Atlanta, the Cubans today released one hostage who complained of high blood pressure, but they're threatening to kill the rest if police attempt a rescue. Atlanta prison warden Joseph Petrovsky says negotiations with the inmates have broken down.
Yesterday morning about 10:15, we had an incident kick off at USP Atlanta that developed very quickly into a riotous situation. We have been working diligently at it until the present time. We have a negotiating team working around the clock, and at this point in time, the negotiations, quite frankly, are at a relative standstill.
Relatives of the Cubans gathered in Washington today. They urged the inmates to release the hostages. Federal officials have offered a moratorium on sending the prisoners back to Cuba, but only if the hostages are released safely in the near future. In Southern California today, an earthquake measuring 6.3 on the Richter scale. It was the second one in 12 hours to shake Southern California. Only minor damage and slight injuries reported on the California side of the border, but officials reported heavier damage across the border in Mexicali, Mexico. They say as many as 650 people were evacuated from buildings suspected of being damaged in that earthquake. Air traffic controllers never told an Air Force pilot that he was near a major population area before he ejected from his fighter plane. The pilotless plane slammed into a hotel near the Indianapolis airport last month, killing 10 people. The FAA today released tapes of a conversation between controllers and Major Bruce Teagarden. Before ejecting, he had asked if he was over a populated area, but he never got a reply. 16 people were killed, 5 others hurt last night when a commuter plane crashed at Homer, Alaska. The Ryanair flight was landing at the Homer Airport when the accident happened. Officials said weather was clear at the time of the crash. An investigation continues. The nation's economy grew at a healthy 4.1% last summer. The Commerce Department figures are better than expected. They show the economy was climbing sharply before the stock market crash occurred in early October. I'm Mark Boardman, reporting for National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of the brief career of Bobby Fuller. Back in 1966, Fuller had the hit I Fought the Law. That same year, Fuller and his band appeared in a poolside scene in the film The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, which starred Boris Karloff, Basil Rathbone, and Patsy Kelly. Later that year, Fuller died under peculiar circumstances. He was 23.
Buddy Holly left more than his hits when he died. He also left West Texas teenagers the dream of becoming rock and roll stars. Buddy Knox, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs, and many others made the pilgrimage to Clovis, New Mexico to record at the studio where Norman Petty had produced Buddy's hits. When they became stars, the next generation looked at them and dreamed. Bobby Fuller was one of them. In the early 60s, he began to make tapes in his living room and went to L.A. to sell them. But he wasn't British, so nobody cared, and he came back to El Paso to rethink things. In the meanwhile, he opened a teen nightclub, The Rendezvous, and, with his brother Randy, started a band. Let Her Dance was the Bobby Fuller Four's first hit, released on a local El Paso label, a record that sounded like what Buddy Holly's answer to the British invasion might have been. Armed with a stack of tapes, the Four went to Hollywood, and this time they found some open ears. They belonged to Bob Keane, the man who'd propelled Ritchie Valens to stardom, and he knew he was onto something when he heard a song they'd recorded that had been written by Sonny Curtis, a former member of Buddy Holly's Crickets. The Law established the Bobby Fuller Four, got them a top 10 hit and a job as the house band at one of the Sunset Strip's hot nightclubs, PJ's, and after that at a teen nightclub called It's Boss. The music they were making was perfect, a blend of the best American folk rock and the British sound. Check out Another Sad and Lonely Night, for instance. But Bobby was itching for bigger things. He'd toured and wasn't happy with the way he was ignored by a lot of the kids in the clubs the band played. He'd had to record other people's stuff just to keep the records coming, and he didn't like that either. Bob Keane was concerned and finally worked out a plan for Bobby to stay in L.A. most of the time and just write and record. Things were looking good. On July 18, 1966, Bobby celebrated his new deal by going out and buying a new Corvette. That evening, his body was found savagely beaten and reeking of gasoline he was found to have swallowed. The official verdict was suicide, but I've never met anybody who believed it. The story may yet come out. A screenplay based on his life is being written. But as long as we have his records, he's never to be forgotten.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. You're listening to Fresh Air. In the early 1960s, when American beat poet Gary Snyder was traveling around the world, he heard several stories about a wandering Japanese poet named Nanao Sakaki. Snyder finally met Sakaki in Japan in the mid-60s and has championed his work ever since. North Point Press has just published a collection of Nanao Sakaki's poems. Snyder wrote the foreword and describes the poetry as carrying on the tradition of the great Japanese and Chinese writers, yet remaining truly unique. Snyder says, "I know of no poems with quite this slant, compassionate, funny, deceptively simple, cosmic, deeply radical, free." We caught up with Sakaki on his visit to California. Here he is reading the title poem from his new book, Break the Mirror.
Break the Mirror. In the morning, after taking cold shower, what a mistake, I look at the mirror. There, a funny guy, gray hair, white beard, wrinkled skin. What a pity, poor, dirty old man. He's not me, absolutely not. Land and life. Fishing in the ocean, sleeping in the desert with stars, building a shelter in mountains, farming the ancient way, singing with coyotes, singing against nuclear war. I will never be tired of life. Now I'm 17 years old, very charming young man. I sit down quietly in lotus position, meditating for nothing. Suddenly, a voice comes to me. To stay young, to save the world, break the mirror.
You started writing after World War II.
Yeah.
And that's when you started traveling also.
Yes.
Why did you never return home after the war?
No, because the whole universe is my home.
And how come you didn't settle down with a 9-to-5 job?
that's a good question. But I thought not fixed a job, just vagabond life, much more rich, and more charming, and more vivid, more alive to me, and to see the world more clearly for me.
The American poets Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg met you in Japan while they were there seeking spiritual guidance and learning about meditation.
Yes.
What did you think of the American poets who were coming to Japan to learn about Japanese traditions? Did their interest surprise you? Did you understand it?
No, it was... First, I felt strange. But now I understand. Western culture, European culture, something in bottom, in deep bottom, something need change. Because too much material civilization. So need something more like footwork or foot gear. I call foot gear, something to stand on. That is meditation, I feel.
You know, I think at about the time that people like Snyder and Ginsberg were coming to Japan to learn about ancient Japanese spiritual traditions, there were so many Japanese people who were really interested in American popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
In jazz music, in
movies.
Oh, sure.
And I was too. Yeah, I was very happy to listen to jazz. I met many American jazz men in Tokyo. Around 50 and 60.
1950 and 1960?
Yeah, and the rock and roll people too.
Now, you first came to America in the late 1960s.
What? Yes, 69.
What?
But before that, I listened to Jefferson Airplane and Grateful Dead and Beatles, and now many young Japanese are listening to reggae.
I have to tell you, I get a real kick out of knowing that Americans were going to Japan to study ancient traditions while Japanese young people were wanting to learn about jazz and rock and roll. Does that strike you as funny, too?
Yeah, so it's I think that is a good relation we exchange. American people start eating sushi, and miso, and tofu, and Japanese eating, young Japanese now making bread without yeast. So it's a good exchange.
You must have really been struck by some of the language and some of the slogans, some of the advertising slogans in America.
Yes. I was very excited. It's good for study foreign language through advertisement.
Is that how you... That's interesting.
That's true. Through, you see, on the magazines, or on radio, on TV. That's a good way to learn foreign language.
You know, I asked you about advertising slogans because you have a poem called Top 10 of American Poetry.
Yes.
Can you read that poem for us?
Sure. The United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem Walt Whitman. The government of the people, by the people, for the people, Thomas Jefferson. You deserve a break today, McDonald. Where science gets down to business, Rockwell International. Kick the letter habit, Bell System. Crime hit everybody, everybody, auto hit back, Chicago Crime Commission. Without chemicals, life itself would be impossible, Monsanto. I think America's future is black, coal black, Atlantic Rich Field Company. Have a Coke and a smile, Coca-Cola. Private property, no trespassing, dead end road, anonymous.
So that's how you learned to speak English, huh?
Yes.
I'd like for you to read another poem.
Which one?
Would you read the poem Valentine's Day?
Okay. You have no touch of class, no touch of uniqueness. No touch of elegance, no touch of mystery. I love you.
I like the poem.
Thank you.
You know, you have described your life as the life of a vagabond.
Yeah.
And it is frequently the fate of vagabonds to be occasionally arrested. Has that happened to you? Have you been arrested during any of your travels?
Oh, yes, sure. But I don't care so much.
What are some of the things you have been arrested for?
No, maybe too strange. And Japanese are more kind of very socially strict life, more than American people. So hard to be vagabond. Here, okay, many hobos, many vagabond in United States, but in Japan, very few. And so police are very careful.
Did people not want you in their neighborhoods? I mean, were people afraid that you would corrupt their children?
Yeah, maybe so. But now Japanese society is really changing, more open. So young people have more freedom by their own choice, not depend on too much on their parents. So it's okay.
I'd like to ask you to read another poem.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read Why Do You Write Poems?
Because my stomach is empty. Because my throat is itching. Because my belly button's laughing. Because my heart is love burning. Why do you write poems? This was my answer.
Poet Nanao Sakaki. His new collection of poems, Break the Mirror, is published by North Point Press. He spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
We're following the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement announced today by Secretary of State Schultz and by Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze in Geneva. Also, a report on Salvador's President Duarte accusing right-wing leader Roberto Dobuson of responsibility for the shooting death several years ago of Archbishop Romero. An interview with Dobuson, also an interview here with former U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador, Robert White, who's been saying for years that Dobuson was the man responsible. We'll also have a follow-up report on the earthquakes in Southern California and on Henry Roth's Shifting Landscape, his first novel in more than 50 years.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Redemption of Elsdon Bird is the first novel by Noel Virtue, a New Zealander now living in London. The story is about a boy who figures out how to sustain his bizarre childhood. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
It's no surprise that Noel Virtue has already been compared to Carson McCullers and Flannery O'Connor, and that James Dickey has written a blurb for the jacket of his first novel. Imagine you are the 10-year-old hero of The Redemption of Elsdon Bird. Your parents are religious fanatics who beat you regularly as if you were a carpet. The aunt who seems to like you dies in a car crash with battery acid all over her face. The aunt who can't stand you is hiding a dead baby, a mummy, in her attic. One uncle hangs himself in his own filth. Another is institutionalized because he does dirty things with members of his own sex. The woman across the street who gave you a glass of milk is arrested for witchcraft. Your only friend kills his brother and sister, and a Chinaman eats your cat. Just to stay sane, you dream up stories and tell them to the lizard you feed with matchsticks dipped in honey, or to dumb animals at the local zoo. You will grow up, of course, to be a writer. You haven't any choice. What is surprising is that none of this happens in the Gothic American South, from which we're accustomed to such swamp fevers of religious and sexual obsession, of the blind and the bloody and the prophetic. It happens instead in New Zealand, about which we have an altogether contradictory set of preconceptions. From New Zealand, we expect characters as gentle as Maori children, or Kiwi, or imported baby lamb. We expect perplexity instead of craziness. And if they must be crazy, they ought to be crazy virtuous, as in Sylvia Ashton Warner, or crazy poetic, as in Janet Frame, or sublimate themselves in detective stories like Nagayo Marsh, not crazy brutalized and crazy grotesque, as in Faulkner and Freud and Dostoevsky. But Noel Virtue, who himself left New Zealand at age 20 to become a keeper of a zoo in Wales before he began to write fiction, sees the child as raw meat for a monstrous feeding frenzy, and the family as a vampire, even in a welfare state. The miracle is that the child will dream himself out of the zoo. No need here for fancy symbolic superstructures or the convenient epiphany. Elsdon's passage is unadorned. The occasional slang, cricky, drongo, pong, and crook, is as plain-spoken and undeceived as the boy himself. What we read is not so much written down as carved in wood, and we believe every painful word of it. It is a whittling on twisted emotions, roots that strangle, corrupted trunks, a black forest in a grim fairy tale of a lost child who must survive among uncomprehending beasts. By naming these beasts, he is redeemed. There must be easier, nicer ways to become a writer, but The Redemption of Elsdon Bird isn't a nice and easy novel. It wants to break our hearts, and so it does.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Redemption of Elsdon Bird by Noel Virtue. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Herbert Block, better known as Herb Block, the Washington Post's Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new recording of Mozart's 22nd and 23rd piano concertos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will share his thoughts on the twisted syntax of most answering machine messages. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.